from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The World Cup is hot this year, and it's hot in the USA. Team USA has performed remarkably well. Our German coach said even before it began that the U.S. could not win this World Cup, that we're not at that level yet. But American fans in Brazil and beyond can taste the possibility of getting there this year. This hour on Point, what would it take to put the USA in the top tier to make America a global soccer powerhouse? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you taste it? Are we close, getting closer to U.S. men holding the World Cup trophy? What would it take? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. As the World Cup round won Monday last week, there the U.S. snagged victory over Ghana. Final minutes of the game, USA 2, Ghana 1. America's John Brooks took the win with the header. And it's not just a bunch of Brazilians cheering down there. Lots of Americans there. And here, sound from Kansas City at that victory. That is now homegrown American soccer enthusiasm. With me first today from Brazil, Rio de Janeiro, is Andrew Das, assistant sports editor for the New York Times. Andrew Das, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. Das, is everybody a German now? Is that a German? It seems like everybody's German in this world, Andrew.
Well, the Das half of me is Dutch, but I am okay. German on my mother's side.
Okay. So. America versus Germany tomorrow, and remind us of the stakes in this game.
Well, it's a huge moment for the U.S., and as disappointed as people were to give up the late goal against Portugal and tie, the U.S. is still in a really strong position to advance. A tie would do the job. A win, obviously, they would win the group. So they just need to kind of get a result here. Even if they lose, they can still advance if the scores break correctly. There's a lot of complicated math involved there. But, you know, they're more likely to advance than not.
Andrew, the last game was in Manaus, way up the Amazon. We saw bugs flying all around in incredible heat and humidity. Where will this game be played?
The game tomorrow is in Recife, which is on the northeast coast of Brazil. There have been Americans at every game, and I imagine there will be thousands more there tomorrow. They seem to be all over Brazil. The U.S. bought, behind Brazil, the U.S. bought the most tickets to the tournament, so they should have some good support tomorrow.
And what about the two teams? I mean, the U.S. had to play in the Amazon. Their German coach, Jürgen Klinsmann, frustrated, critical of FIFA for giving Germany an extra day of rest before the U.S.-German matchup. Here's a little tape from the U.S. German coach, Jürgen Klinsmann.
We have one day less to recover. They played yesterday. We played today. We played in Amazon. They played in a very kind of... locations where they don't have to travel much. You know, everything was done for the big favorites to go and move on.
Everything done for the big favorites. We're talking this hour about how the U.S. might become one of those eventually, maybe becoming now. But what about this extra day for the Germans? Is that seen as a big deal in the competition, Andrew?
It is a big deal. For the U.S. to become a favorite, a lot was made of Clinton's comments about how the U.S. couldn't win the World Cup, but there was nothing wrong about that. The U.S. can't win the World Cup today. I mean, let's be realistic. They can, but they've really surprised some people with their play. I think even some Europeans. And to think that they can't get a result against Germany undervalues Clinton and his players a lot. He may be sandbagging a little when he talks about how they got an extra day of rest, and everybody looks out for the favorites. He knows what he's doing.
He knows what he's doing, and in comes the USA. What are you hearing, the talk around the World Cup this year, the talk about Team USA, Andrew? Is it gaining more respect? The U.S. has not been a big soccer nation. Is this team climbing up their respect ranks?
I would think they are. As more and more Americans play overseas, as Major League Soccer, the league in the U.S. grows in value and stature. people respect it a little more. But when you come to the World Cup and you beat a team like Ghana and you have a team like Portugal essentially beat for 93 and a half minutes, you know, people can't argue that you can't compete at this level.
And I guess they're not anymore. We'll see what happens with the USA and Germany tomorrow. Andrew Das in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro, assistant sports editor for the New York Times. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Have a great day.
There was a time when soccer was seen as a big snooze in the USA. The Simpsons had fun with it in 1997. Here's a crowd watching a soccer game, disinterested as an American announcer explains what's happening on the field from The Simpsons.
Boring!
Come on, you snorers! Do something!
Halfback passes to the center. Back to the wing. Back to the center. Center holds it. Holds it. Holds it.
And you hear Homer Simpson saying, boring there. And that was an American attitude for a long, long time. This week, different story. After the USA tied Portugal, Stephen Colbert chanted out all the scenarios under which the American team could still advance in the World Cup by beating Germany on Thursday or not.
We're number one. As long as we beat Germany, also we could tie them. We'd still get through on points. And we can even lose. But then it comes down to math. If Portugal beats Ghana by less than 5 goals, or Ghana beats Portugal by only 1 goal, then we'd advance on goal differential. They can even tie. That would still work. USA?
Stephen Colbert with his variation on the We're Number One chant. But he took the time to go through it, and Americans are listening. With us now from Berkeley, California, Paul Kennedy, editor-in-chief for Soccer America. Paul Kennedy, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Culver City, California, Andrew Llewellyn, a writer for ESPN's Grantland blog, contributor to ESPN Magazine, also former college soccer player at the College of Worcester in Ohio, former youth soccer coach. Andrew Llewellyn, welcome. Thanks very much for joining us as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Paul Kennedy, are we on a new trajectory here? Is USA men's soccer earning some new spears? Can you tell in this World Cup competition?
The interest in the World Cup has grown since 2006 by 50% each World Cup in terms of spectator interest. And along with that, in terms of what they've done on the field, last time the U.S. made it to the second round. This time they have a very good chance of making it to the second round. And now going back 7 World Cups, the U.S. will probably have gone through now 4 of the 7 times. So it's now a contender, which is the first step to becoming a really great country for soccer.
But here, Andrew, we've got the coach saying, you know, we're still not a World Cup winner. Is there a sense this time out that we're getting closer, that the U.S. could join that rank, those ranks of countries who people, you know, year in and year out say you've got to watch them? Could we end up in the same kind of conversations where Germany is all the time?
I think it's possible. You know, I mean, I think it's something that honestly has been going on since 2002 when the United States made it to the quarterfinals of the World Cup and lost a heartbreaking game to Germany. And since then, that you know, they're always sort of at times in the conversation of some of the best teams. And honestly, I think Jurgen Klinsmann sometimes says things, and I'm not sure why exactly he says them. You know, watching this World Cup, I'm going to actually disagree with Andrew Dawson and say the way that things have fallen and the way that we've seen parity in the competition, and honestly the way the United States have played, I've been so impressed with their character and their determination, which we honestly haven't seen in the last 2 World Cups from the U.S. I think anything is possible. I really do, and I think that it's an extremely exciting time for the team and for the players on the team and for all the kids watching them who want to be on the team and all the Americans at home watching them.
Paul Kennedy, you've been editor at Soccer America for a long time. Can you believe your ears when you hear a smart, you know, observer like Andrew Llewellyn say anything is possible, anything could happen here, even the top?
I can go back to 2002 where I was in Korea, and before the tournament, the U.S. would have gotten zero chance of going through in a group that included Portugal, which at that time was one of the favorites, and the U.S. beat them 3-2. And I think what was most amazing was when the U.S. played Portugal Sunday night was that the U.S. was expected to win. And that's something that's different than before. I mean, obviously, Portugal had some problems with some injuries and missing players, but the U.S. is now competitive. And I think the next step is going to be if the U.S. can find a player like Cristiano Ronaldo, who was that player who at the end broke all our hearts with that tremendous cross.
Is there any reason that the U.S. won't eventually produce a player, players of that level, Paul?
No, I think it's the first thing is making sure we can find him. In the past, the old joke was that we had Lionel Messi or Pele in our backyard, and American soccer was so messed up that it couldn't find him. And I think that's one of the things that's changed a lot in the last couple of years, thanks to the U.S. Soccer Federation and also Major League Soccer, is that the scouting system of finding players as young as 12, 13, 14, 15 years old is much better. So if that player out there who's that next Messi is there, we're now sure we'll find him.
Andrew, maybe that player in this country isn't playing soccer at all. Maybe they're playing American football or basketball or tennis or something.
Maybe. Maybe they're not, though. I mean, I think that, you know, there's about 8 million kids playing soccer in the United States, and there's 3,700 playing in the Development Academy, and I think that U.S. soccer is doing a much better job finding those top players, and those kids are seeing path to a professional team in a way they never have before.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Team USA at the World Cup and what it would take to make American soccer a world powerhouse. They've looked pretty darn good this time out. We can almost taste it. What would it take to go right on up to that top tier? Andrew Llewellyn is with us from Culver City, California, writer for Grantland, ESPN sports and pop culture offshoot blog, contributor to ESPN magazine, former college soccer player himself. Paul Kennedy's here, editor-in-chief and general manager of Soccer America, big U.S. soccer magazine. Here was round two match on Saturday, Jermaine Jones scoring the first goal for USA against Portugal, tying up the game in the second half.
Jones. Oh, yes!
That match on Sunday, of course, but it ended in tears with a tie just in the last seconds of the game. Do Americans believe they can do better? They can really go? Well, this ESPN commercial would have you think so. ESPN pumping up the soccer world. But here was the U.S. coach, Jurgen Klinsmann, on June 11th telling reporters that Americans should keep their feet on the ground and not count on the U.S. winning the World Cup. Just not realistic, said the U.S. coach.
Let's get that group first done, and then the sky is the limit. Yeah? But beforehand, half a year before, or even now today, before the World Cup starts, to say that we should win the World Cup is just not realistic.
Andrew Llewellyn, that wasn't the only time he said this. Is this Jurgen Klinsmann playing some kind of mind game or just being very frank? Or, I mean, nobody can say at the beginning they're going to win it, but he seemed to say more than that. He said, we cannot win this World Cup, he told the New York Times. We're not at that level yet.
He did say we cannot win the World Cup. I don't live inside the mind of Jurgen Klinsmann, yeah. So I don't know exactly what he's thinking. I think it's realistic to say that in terms of not getting, you know, the expectations too high, at least kind of at a national level, and to think that we're ready to win the World Cup. Maybe he's protecting his own work to if they don't win the World Cup, it's not a failure on his part. I think that, you know, it's a matter of, you know, what he wanted to see was this team go into the group and play well and do well, and they've done that. He's formed a team that is capable of doing well at this World Cup, and frankly, I think a lot of people think is kind of modeled for the next 4 years and heading into the next World Cup. And you know, he went into a really tough group, and you don't want to set the expectation that you can get out of that group and you're going to win the World Cup. But as I said, I mean, I think the way that this World Cup has gone and the way the team has played, I do think there are a lot of possibilities. I think anything is possible, and we'll just have to wait and see starting again tomorrow.
Paul Kennedy, what would the formula look like? Maybe we're seeing it already. You and Andrew say, well, find your own Ronaldo or superstar. Sure, that would be great. If you could lay out a formula for taking it right on up to put soccer, U.S. soccer in that top tier and put it there firmly, what would that look like, Paul?
It would be a numbers game, very simply. For a team to win the World Cup, they really need more than 11 players, and that's going to be something we'll really see on Thursday night, is whether U.S. has the depth of talent to keep up with Germany, which is considered one of the deepest teams in the tournament. A lot of players are tired, and so that means that other players have to come forward, and that's something that's going to have to happen across the board in MLS, in the youth programs that are being developed. Is that if the U.S. can produce, double the number of good players they have now, then they have the chance to win a World Cup, because you're always going to deal with injuries, you're always going to deal with a little bad luck with players, but that's going to make the bottom line difference is 20, 30 good players instead of 10 or 12 that they have right now.
Andrew, we're a 300 million plus nation. We ought to be able to come up with 20 plus players. Here are much smaller nations who are fielding that kind of team. What down in the root ball of American soccer is required to end up with that number of tip-top players on the field for Team USA?
I think a lot of it's going to come down to how we are finding and identifying young players and developing them, from the ages, young ages, maybe around 10 up through the high school age. And then at the very crucial age of about 18 to 22, where the United States really is kind of lacking in player development. The U.S. soccer developed their development academy in 2007 to address a lot of the issues that they saw in U.S. soccer. The development academy, now you have kids playing in one team all year round with one coach on a very specific schedule. I think that's changing things a lot. It enables U.S. soccer to basically implement a methodology nationwide and sort of a coaching curriculum. And every MLS team has their own youth academy team, and they're investing millions, tens of millions of dollars into developing those academies and training their players. And I think that's really where the change is going to come, is from an effort within America to find a curriculum to identify these players and train them, because that's what the best nations, Germany is a good example, Spain, Italy, Holland, they have very, very strong domestic club systems, and they start training their kids at a very young age, and that's how they identify talent, and that's how they develop a style in them. And I think that's really the direction that American soccer and U.S. soccer has to take to develop a team of the sort of elite caliber.
Do we have a big enough ground level input? I mean, we're, depending how you count, I don't know, we're in the second, maybe even the third generation now of kids who have played soccer from very early on and know the game from that level in the schoolyard. Lots of parents standing at the sideline who get to know it there. Do we have a big enough basic part of the population, Paul Kennedy, who's coming in early enough in soccer to end up at the World Cup with the kind of team you need?
That is not the problem. The number of players playing is they're there. It's nurturing them. Right now, the U.S. at the level of players 15, 16, 17 has a group of players who are probably as good as any other players in the world. What's going to happen to those players, those 10, 12 players who are really exceptional players over the next 4 years. And that's really going to be a challenge for MLS, because up until now, for all the money they've spent in player development, which is a lot more than they did before, which was zero, it's still a lot less than big clubs in Europe might spend. And most of these young players are being drawn into clubs abroad, which may help them a little bit in terms of their player development, but is a big gamble in their lives to leave home and move abroad, where it's much dicier situation.
Andrew, is that because for all of the enthusiasm right now with the World Cup, Americans just don't watch soccer as much, so Major League Soccer here doesn't have the same kind of revenue base, the kind of cash to put into development?
I mean, I think if it's part of it is a money issue, I think it also is, for so long, Americans have seen going and playing in Europe as the thing to do. And that's beginning to change. And Paul is exactly right, is the issue. And if you talk to coaches in MLS, American coaches, Bruce Arena has said this to me, like Paul said, we're doing a very good job developing players up to about age 17. It's when they get to that age 17, 18 that things change. Do they go to college, which is kind of highly criticized for not being an ideal training environment, but at the same time, a number of players on this U.S. team played in college, including Clint Dempsey, who's, mm-hmm. you know, arguably the best American player.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, some MLS clubs are developing basically minor league teams to help that category of players. In Europe, a lot of players that age, you know, are either playing in their reserve teams or they get loaned out to other clubs where they get training. So that, I think, is kind of the most challenging area. Is it financial? It definitely is, but it's also about just developing the infrastructure and having both the money, but also the resources and the ideas about how you're going to implement and change at that level to solve that problem.
Do they want it this year, Team USA? Can they taste it like a lot of fans? It sounds like it here. This is midfielder Jermaine Jones talking in anticipation of the Round 3 match against Germany tomorrow, talking with reporters about what the Team USA, is thinking now.
We want to win that game. If we win, we go to the next round. And we was like 30 seconds close to, against Portugal, close to finish that. But now we have a tough game, the next tough game. But we still have the chance to go through. And on this chance, we want to take this time now.
They're with the German again, the German accent. Andrew Llewellyn, his dad was, he was born in Berlin. His dad was U.S. military, German mom. I mean, how much of Jermaine Jones' talent, for example, is because he grew up in that environment, Andrew?
I think a lot of it has to do with that he grew up in that environment. He was in a very good club system at a very young age. And we've got a number of German-Americans on the team. Jermaine Jones is one of them, Fabian Johnson. Those are the two that have contributed the most, obviously. John Anthony Brooks, the second half against Ghana. But I mean, me personally, I have concerns about basically trying to recruit German-American players to play for the American team. I don't think that's kind of a long-term solution. I think it's, you know, here in the United States, where are we finding those players? And with that, there's a lot of kids, you know, who are children of immigrants who could be American players or get American citizenship. And how do we retain those players and prevent them from going and playing for, you know, basically the country of their parents or one of their parents? And so managing both, you know, German-American or French-American or whatever it might be, those players, as well as, you know, kids who have immigrated to the U.S., along with all the millions of kids in the U.S. who just grow up playing the sport, it's in their playgrounds, you know, and at school, is really the challenge.
I mean, I'm looking down here at birthplaces on Team USA, and yes, you've got Fort Wayne and Boca Raton and Overland Park in Kansas and Dallas and Tampa and Homer Glen in Illinois, Mobile, Alabama, but you've got Munich and Frankfurt and Berlin. You've got dual citizenship team members from Norway and Iceland. But it's Team USA. Ernest is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Ernest, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the USA will be able to pull it out because I believe soccer nowadays is not predictable anymore. Formerly, in the days before, you can predict soccer, but nowadays, any team that is able to go to the World Cup can win. And every player that are in there, Jermaine Jones, Brooks, whoever that is playing for the U.S. team, I bet you, they all have what is called the self-confidence. And I believe they can pull it up and they can win. We don't want to get a draw. They can win as long as you have that self-confidence in you.
But, Ernest, we're up against teams from countries where soccer, what they call football, has been number one for forever. And for us, it's still relatively new. Are we past that problem in the U.S., Ernest?
No, we have really not passed that problem. But I believe the way the U.S. have really drawn it up, like one of your guests there, Andrew, I think I definitely agree with what he said. The way the curriculum is being drawn now in the U.S. is getting everybody involved. In those days, we don't have those type of curriculum. We don't have the money. And I tell you, the way the parents are bringing their kids into the soccer nowadays is really something amazing. And with that scope, it don't matter whether it's football. I'm from a country where we call it football. I'm from African country.
Uh-huh.
Guess what? We played in a field where there is no grass. We played anywhere, hard turf, any place at all. But nowadays, U.S. have everything you can think of. It's just a matter of getting more people in there, more people to give some money, and let's move it on. USA is definitely going to win that game. No draw at all.
Ernest, we're right there with you. There's a gung-ho, let's go get it, and let's get it right now. View from New Orleans. One more here, Columbia, South Carolina. Allison, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to share my story. I'm a brand new soccer fan in that I have just spent the last 10 days in Costa Rica on a mission trip.
Yeah.
And talk about embracing the sport. It is part of their being, and we were engulfed in it. And it was like magic. Last Friday, we were able to go to the National Center where they showed the game on a huge TV, and we were embraced by them. We chanted, Ticos, Ticos, Ticos. And I found myself coming back to the States and watching it last night, which previously I never would have done.
Do you think that it, I mean, World Cup fever aside, is it big enough to build a wave to make the U.S. one day even number one, Allison?
I would love to think that. I was so moved by it, the passion that they feel for the game. And if we could possibly get a quarter of our population to feel like that, it would be just wonderful camaraderie.
Sunday night's game, 24.7 million viewers on ESPN and Univision. Those are big numbers by any measure. Allison in South Carolina, thanks for your call. Paul Kennedy, Andrew Llewellyn, please stand by. With us right now from Foxborough, Massachusetts, is Mike Burns. He is general manager for the New England Revolution. Professional soccer, played for the U.S. national team in the 92 Olympics, the 1998 FIFA World Cup. Mike Burns, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
We're great, and it's been so much fun to watch the Team USA, the U.S. team this year. How do you see the trajectory American soccer is on? Could we make it into the top tier and be seen as playing at that level? Are we there now?
We're not there now consistently enough, but do I think we are on the right path and the right trajectory? Absolutely. I feel over the last 20, 25 years, there's not a country on the planet that has had as much growth in the game of soccer as we have in the United States, from the success of hosting the World Cup in 94 to qualifying for every World Cup since 1990, the launch of MLS in 96 with 10 teams, and next year we'll have 21 teams, the number of soccer-specific stadiums in this country. So, you know, that's it. In the scope of the history of soccer, 20, 25 years is a very, very short time. But what we've done and where we've come from in the last 25 years, as I said, I think it's unprecedented. We're on the right path and trajectory, and I have no doubt in the future, and I can't put a year on it, but in the future, we will be one of the top teams in the world. I have no doubt about it.
Mike, what portion of American professional soccer players are now playing abroad at some point in their young careers?
When you say young players, you mean youth players? Or
no, I mean the soccer players are generally young, right? They're not playing when they're 50. So by the time they're playing with you or, you know, in the years around when they join you, what percentage play abroad? Get that experience.
It's hard to say what percentage. I mean, you're always, until we become, and we're on the path, I think, there as well, but until we are considered one of the top leagues in the world, and we're not kidding ourselves, we're not La Liga yet, we're not Serie A or the Premiership, but our league has grown leaps and bounds from 96 to now in terms of the quality of play, the quality of the international players that we're attracting to play in this league. But you're always going to have certain players in the U.S. that have that desire to play abroad, and I don't think that's a bad thing, but the landscape and the structure of our academies and our youth system has changed as such that we now have close to 100 players signed that have come through our youth teams in MLS that have signed professional contracts. And to use one of our homegrown players as an example, we signed Diego Fagundes at 15, and without question, for him to sign a pro contract at that young age and to be incorporated into our first team and playing with professionals, purely from a soccer standpoint, he has grown leaps and bounds than he would have taking a different route.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Team USA at the World Cup and what it would take to make American soccer a world powerhouse. They have looked pretty good this time out, pretty darn good. We can almost taste it, but what about that next jump to the top tier? Can we do it? Development, there's plenty going on. Here's sound of U.S. Soccer's Under-17-18 Championship in Houston between the FC Dallas and Vancouver Whitecaps Development Academy teams.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
out there working up that next generation of play. Fans watching closely. U.S. versus Germany tomorrow. Here's one fan in Chicago saying, maybe we can do it.
The good thing, we have Klinsmann, which is, he is a German captain, so probably he knows some of, like, the weakness of the German team, and let's hope for the best.
Everybody sounds a little German today. Here's American goalkeeper Tim Howard talking with ESPN about how the team's recovering after their disappointing last-second tie with Portugal on Sunday. The Heat, he said, no problem.
Half of our guys play in the MLS, and they play in Houston, and you know, in July, and it's hot. It's not easy, but we're players who have grown up playing in those conditions, so it's nothing new for us. The European players don't always get that, you know, and so that heat for us is hopefully will be an advantage.
Let's go. Let's do it. Andrew Llewellyn is with us, writer for ESPN's Grantland, joining us from Culver City, California. Paul Kennedy in Berkeley, California, editor-in-chief of Soccer America. And Mike Burns is here, general manager for the New England Revolution, former pro player himself. Monica's calling from New York, Geneva, New York. Monica, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I experience this every 4 years. Americans are gung-ho about soccer at that time. If we give the team, the soccer team's support, then we would definitely be up there. But Americans do not care for soccer, and that's the biggest problem. But every 4 years there are some games, and they watch it, and if they win, woo, but they do not support the American soccer teams.
Monica's not buying it. Mike Burns, I mean, you're out there fielding a team every year. You've got a little Eurovision there saying it doesn't look like enough steady soccer support still in this country to put the U.S. in the top tier. Mike, what do you say?
Yeah, no, I would have to disagree with the last caller's comments and feelings. I think that both from a league standpoint, from an MLS standpoint, and from a national team standpoint, on both the men's and the women's side, I think soccer does support the national teams and does support MLS. And if that wasn't the case, we wouldn't have a professional men's league around, and the viewership for the U.S.-Portugal game wouldn't have broken all sorts of records. So I will respectfully disagree with the last caller.
We take a little Euro view there. Peter in Providence, Rhode Island. You're on the air, Peter. What do you think?
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I've been wearing a little bit of orange the last week and a half, and most people, or many people, know why I'm wearing orange, because I'm of Dutch descent. But I'll know that American soccer has really broken through. On July 5th, 1982, I was in Rome, Italy. You didn't need to watch TV or listen to the radio to know the score, because every time Italy scored, there was a giant roar. And every time the Brazilians scored, there was a kind of a.
The whole city.
You could sleep in the middle of the street for 2 hours, and you would not have been disturbed. Of course, 2 minutes after the game was over, it was complete traffic jam and total chaos.
Yeah, yeah. No, Peter,
when that happens in the U.S., yeah, we're there.
Then we're there. Andrew Llewellyn in Culver City, California. We've had reports from Costa Rica, from Rome there, on how their whole country just go nuts. We've had big numbers for the World Cup in Brazil, but still, it's not the whole country. Does it take that degree of engagement, yearning, soccer fixation to put a country's team at the top?
I don't think it necessarily takes that. I mean, I very much agree with what Mike was saying, that we've come extremely far in 20, 25 years, and that's not a very long time. I mean, we're talking about Italy and Germany. These are countries where soccer, football, whatever you want to call it, has been, you know, the number one sport for a century. I don't think that, you know, we'll ever be in the United States and be able to register the score of a game without watching the television. And it's just because, you know, there are other major sports here. And if there are other major sports, there's other stuff on TV or whatever it might be. I don't really see that happening. But I don't think that we need that kind of engagement for the team to win. I mean, the team is going to win based on the character of the team and the quality of the players. And I think that, you know, that's something that American soccer players, you know, this sort of idea that, oh, people don't care about America, has been going on, you know, since the U.S. qualified for the 90 World Cup. It went on in the 94 World Cup. It's still kind of going on, and it just takes a group of players who doesn't really care what people think to do the very best they want to do.
Just go do it. Paul Kennedy, of course, American women have already done it. I mean, they've taken the World Cup. They know exactly what that is. Can the men's team learn something from American women's soccer, Paul?
It's very hard to compare the two because on the women's side, at the end of the day, there's maybe four or five good countries that play women's soccer. So the competition, it just isn't the same. But I would say that it would take the same dedication, the same interest, and also the the creation of a dream that was done with the 1999 Women's World Cup that's kept women's soccer growing here in the United States. And I would just add that. On the men's side, what it has so much in its favor is the demographics, you know, of the young male urban fan who is embracing soccer bigger than any other sport. And that's something that I truly believe. And it's important to remember that you know, 10, 20 years from now, they'll have sons and daughters 15, 16 years old. So they'll be able to translate that enthusiasm for soccer into their child's lives, which up until now has been missing for so many Americans who knew nothing about the sport when their kids got into it.
Mike Burns, what about money? Football, basketball, baseball, American kids can dream not only of wonderful sports, but of big money. Soccer, of course, you can go professional, you can make a living, but it's not the same scale. How much does that matter, do you think, Mike?
I mean, I think it does matter a little bit. I think because, listen, all young kids today that are into athletics and into sports, and you see on the ticker that this NBA player or NFL player signs a 10-year, $100 million deal or a Major League Baseball player. And so, we can't kid ourselves and say that it doesn't matter. Because it does to a certain extent, and I think we have to continue to make progress. We have so much competition in this country with the other four major sports, and we are seeing some more kids and some better athletes hopefully are going to choose soccer, and our league is continuing to growing. And in terms of those big salary contracts, I mean, MLS just lured Michael Bradley and Clint Dempsey back, and those are big-time contracts to American players. So I think the young kids do look at that, and I think it does matter to a certain extent for sure.
Michael in Lincoln, Nebraska. Michael, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you see, Michael?
Well, I'm a Dutch expatriate, hence the accent, and I heard you comment on, well, we are getting better at everything because we're now scouting kids at the age of 14. And I just wanted to say that my world-famous home team, Ajax, starts scouting boys at the age of 6. And by the time they reach the first team around 17, 18, if they do, they have been professionally trained for 12 years and been playing in the same system and have always played against other teams that are 2-3 years their senior. So I hope that America will go the same way. Otherwise, you will never reach that level.
The Dutchman speaks. Andrew Llewellyn's pro scouting at 6. Do you see U.S. on that track?
Well, I think... I mean, we said 13 or 14 because that's the youngest age in the development academy. I think a part of this that's really crucial to keep in perspective is the sort of cultural aspects of what we're talking about. So, you know, Ajax, for example, or Barcelona, you know, two of the top European teams with some of the top, you know, youth development programs. They're also in those programs, Barcelona, I know, they're grading education with that. They're so, like, there's a kid from Los Angeles, Sam Borden, who's in the Barcelona Academy, the first American to do that. His parents decided to move to Spain and live there with him. But part of being in that academy is you're going to school and you're training. We don't have that in the United States right now. We don't have all the kids in the development academy here, you know, that's separate from school. They're driving to practice every day. And so that's the other issue is that how do we sort of incorporate that kind of developmental structure with the reality of American life and with kids going to school and being, you know, normal kids? And how do we put them in environments where they can grow as soccer players or whatever kind of athletes they are. You know, I think one of the other issues is we put kids into competitive environments too quickly, and that often that's not necessarily the best environment for them. So how do we incorporate, you know, what it is to be an American kid with this sort of training that's on par with sort of European counterparts?
Hey, Paul, here's a listener online writing about the American demographics. It says, the more diverse the American culture becomes, as our Hispanic population grows, this will take care of itself. What about that, Paul, in terms of enthusiasm for the game, tradition running in families around the game? I don't know, kind of feeling it in the bones. We know there are big changes on that front in this country.
You really see that in, say, in California, where a lot of the players coming through that I mentioned that are the age of 15, 16, 17 are from Southern California, many from the San Diego area, some who actually are from Tijuana and cross the border to go to school here. So that interest there is very important. And again, as I said, it's what is so important is it's driven through the family. From the fathers, from the uncles, and that's something that I think that will change a little bit in more American families as young males grow up and have children and pass on their passion for soccer that you know has been there for dads and all around the world.
More diverse, maybe some of that comes right in with it. Alston in Hartford, Connecticut. Alston, you're on the air.
I'd just like to comment on the fact that the U.S. has a great ability to grind out results compared to squads like this past World Cup, England and Spain. They've got a wealth of superstars, and when they need to put results together, they just can't seem to do it. And I think that the U.S. needs to be applauded for really grinding and grinding it out in, you know, against Portugal and against Ghana.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I appreciate your call, Alston. Mike, what about it in terms of a national style? Klinsmann talks about this. Lots of people talk about it. You know, our caller says we may not have the superstars, but we grind it out. Do you see an emerging American style of soccer? And if you were to describe it, Mike, what would it be?
That's a really interesting question. And I don't know if if you think of the Brazilians or the Dutch or the Spanish teams of recent, you think of or English, you think of a style. And I don't know if we really have a style yet. I think without question, the comment about the grittiness and the American heart and desire and the commitment and all, that all holds true. But we have such a diverse diversity of cultures and nationalities in this country that it's a very unique style right now, because you have some very technical players and then you have some hard-nosed players. So I don't think that's evolved yet to where and I think sometimes your coach influences that. Mm-hmm. Right now, and Jurgen obviously has a German background, and so that plays into it. But it's I wouldn't say we have a direct style per se, and that is continually evolving and changing depending on the personnel because of the size of the country and the number of kids we have playing. And so that it's a great question. I just don't think we're viewed worldwide yet as some of the other countries that have more specific styles.
Andrew, you talked at the top about the character and determination of this team, but let's talk national character for a minute. Does it end up showing itself in a country's style of play in soccer? And if so, what does that mean for the U.S.?
I think it absolutely does show itself in a sort of style of play. Germany is known for being very efficient. Brazil is very creative. You see these things in teams. Holland has this kind of blend of creativity with very, you know, sort of stylish play. And this is, as Mike said, it's a great question, and I know it's, you know, Klinsmann has talked about it, we want to have an American style, and I honestly feel like that performance, particularly against Ghana, was one of the first times that I saw, if not an American style, a real American character.
Describe it for us then. Put some articulation around it.
To me, as Mike said, we had some very technical players. The goal by Clint Dempsey was really a world-class goal. It was exceptional. And with that, then you pair, say, Jermaine Jones and Kyle Beckerman, very sort of tough, hard defensive midfielders. The defense, you know, for the most part, was fairly organized and aggressive and sort of contained. And, you know, we ground out a win against Ghana, and that's not something that America usually does. And it's like, to me, it's this kind of blend of some technicality, some people being able to execute something that I would call elite, that I would call world-class when you need to do it. And then combining that with just real determination. And I think that's something Klinsmann has instilled. If you go to training, you watch him, watch the team train, he's extremely intense. He's always beside the training field yelling and encouraging people. And that you're starting to see. And so that's what I'm excited to see is that I see character and there is style. And so we're beginning to combine those things in a way that I think all the other great, you know, national teams are able to do.
Mike Burns, you're a pro general manager right there. The next step in wherever the U.S. team goes is tomorrow against Germany. What would you advise this team on the field against Deutschland?
I'd advise them to win.
How? The mystery is how.
After Germany's first game against Ghana, for me, after the first round of games, there wasn't a team in the tournament that played better than Germany. They completely dismantled Portugal. They were one of the pre-tournament favorites for a reason. Timmy Howard said it before the Portugal game, and unfortunately the U.S. made a couple mistakes. He said, listen, he thought that they needed to play flawless and mistake-free against Portugal. I think that even holds more true for this game against Germany. I think the U.S. and Germany will both play very smart. I don't foresee any major changes from the U.S. in terms of their approach to the game. I don't want to say they'll play conservative, but I do see us getting a result. And when I say that, I mean, it could be a tie, but I do see the U.S. advancing. I think they have as much confidence that they may have ever had in any World Cup. Right now, even after giving up the late goal to Portugal, and I think that's going to go a long way, and it's going to be needed, and they're going to have to play very good tomorrow, because Germany really only has one way to play, and that's full throttle, and they don't take their foot off the accelerator often. But I think that the game is there for us to get something out of it and to move on.
All we need is a tie, but that's a tall ladder to climb in itself. But I'm sure many people will be rooting for that in a big, big way. Mike Burns, general manager with the New England Revolution Pro Team here in the States. Mike, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Andrew Llewellyn at Grantland, ESPN. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And Paul Kennedy, editor-in-chief at Soccer America. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.